The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The following is a conversation between Ellen Futter, president of the American Museum of Natural History, and Denver Frederick, host of The Business of Giving, on AM 970 The Answer, WNYM, in New York City.
There are few institutions that generate such universal love and respect as does the American Museum of Natural History. And we can add appreciation to that as well, as this year they are celebrating their 150th anniversary. And here to share with us their story and what they have planned for their sesquicentennial anniversary is Ellen Futter, the president of the American Museum of Natural History. Good evening, Ellen, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
Good evening, and thank you for having me.
So it was 1869. The incorporation papers were signed on April 6, when the American Museum of Natural History came into being. What is the founding story of that institution, Ellen?
Well, it's really an interesting story because so many of New York's civic leaders were admiring of institutions of natural history around the world, particularly, I think, the British Natural History Museum. And they thought, as the leaders of this great city in New York, that New York ought to have one of its own. And so they founded the American, in contrast to the British, Museum of Natural History right here in New York City.
And it was originally in Central Park, correct?
It was originally in the Armory in Central Park. And then, of course, we developed our own site and facility.
The breadth and scope of the museum is simply remarkable. You have some 34 million objects in your collection. Provide us with an overview of the museum.
Well, what's really unique about the American Museum of Natural History is precisely what you said, its scope. There are many natural history museums that might cover the biological sciences, but they don't necessarily cover astrophysics, earth and planetary sciences, not to mention anthropology. And our scope is all of that, which means pretty much, not absolutely, but pretty much everything can fall within our ambit. And that's a very luxurious place to be, particularly in terms of presenting topics to the public. But separate from just the intellectual scope, the content scope, is what happens inside the museum. The fact that we not only have those collections of 34 million specimens and objects, which is enormous, but also that we have 200 research scientists on staff, that we have probably the largest natural history library all in one place and under our roof in the Western Hemisphere, that in addition to the collections and the library and the scientists, and the laboratories, many of them among the most high-tech that you can find anywhere. We also have our own graduate school. We give our own PhD in comparative biology, and we also give an MAT in the Master of Teaching Science, which has never been more important than it is today. So that's a great deal of scope, plus exhibitions, which is what the public knows us best for.
Yeah, that's right.
45 permanent galleries, plus the Rose Center for Earth and Space with its planetarium and space show, as well as having a huge educational enterprise. We're training some 4,000 to 5,000 teachers a year in teaching science education. We have extensive public programs. We're the most visited museum in New York City for children visiting in school groups with teachers and parents and also with camp groups. So it's an enormous sweep of activity and an enormous opportunity to bring science and nature and human cultures to the public.
How many visitors do you have every year, and where do they tend to gravitate to once they step into the museum?
Well, I love all of my children equally. but having said that, we have about 5 million visitors a year, which is a lot of visitors. And there are certain things they always love, and then there's surprises. So among the always and most popular, obviously dinosaurs. but the big blue whale in the Milstein Hall of Ocean Life.
It takes three days to clean that, doesn't it?
It does, actually. It's a great favorite. The planetarium is enormous. Popular. And of course, some things post night at the museum, the movie, everybody wants to go to Pacific Peoples and see the wonderful statue that they remember so well. The dioramas are forever popular. Mm-hmm. The Bernard Hall of North American Mammals, the Akeley Gallery of African Mammals. These are places of childhood memories, including my own.
Yeah.
Really very, very special. I always say about the dioramas that they were actually the first virtual reality.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. Yeah. And you can actually spend the night in the museum, can't you?
You can actually spend a night at the museum on purpose now.
Yeah.
You know, it's a remarkable thing. That night at the museum where you can sleep under the whale, it's magical. And before you get to sleep under the whale, you get a flashlight tour of the dinosaur galleries, a late night viewing of the space show. It's pretty fun.
Yeah, it sounds that way. Well, museums help to contextualize data and information for us. So let me ask you to contextualize this. And how do you see the role of the Natural History Museum in the broader society?
Well, it's a very important question because as such a hybrid institution that does science, education, exhibition, public programs, we have a lot of – everybody's our audience.
Mm-hmm.
And so on the one hand, from a scientific perspective, very much we have to preserve – and we want to – and steward the collections. These are the evidence. This is one of the most important records of life on this good earth. And it's the evidence on which much science is done. And evidence and facts really matter. We take them seriously. In addition, the scientists conduct some 100 plus expeditions, field expeditions, all over the world every single year. And so the active science and the research that's taking place right in the laboratories, very often highly interdisciplinary, high tech, and addressing major issues of our time is one critical aspect of what we do. Second, we want to bring and translate that scientific work and other scientific work to the public. Most of the issues of our time are actually scientifically based today, and most of the issues that the public is so concerned with and should be so concerned with, human health, the environment, the possibility of life beyond Earth, and I could go on with a long
You're
list.
Absolutely right.
These are energy policy. These are things people go to the voting booth on. Think about the health issues today, vaccinations. I mean, these things really, really matter. So what we try to do is bring current topics to the public, not as a lesson and not as a textbook, but through a unique style of interpretation and presentation of an exhibition. And then we take an exhibition and a theme that we've developed, and we translate it for teachers, for schools, for presentation on the internet, and for learning anywhere, anytime, by individuals, by children, adults, and families, alone, together, however is best for them, in whatever language, at whatever age.
Yeah, and you're taking these current issues and you're presenting them in a very current way, because museums are truly in the digital age. Apps, learning portals, virtual and augmented reality, these things are all being deployed to enhance the visitor's experience. How do you approach these emerging technologies, and how do you layer it on to what the museum already was?
It's a really interesting question. I mean, when the digital world was first emerging in museums, I think there was some, not so much in ours, honestly, because as a scientific institution, we tend to embrace technology very fast.
Yes.
We live it and we breathe it. But nonetheless, as a general matter, I think for institutions, there was a sense that, well, you know, That's one side of life, and then there's the actual what happens on site.
Mm-hmm.
And then more and more they began to come together. And from my perspective, and I know our museum's perspective, they really are mutually reinforcing. And the way that we think about it is that visitors now come to us or are visitors both online and on site. And what we want is a flow for them to be able to go back and forth from the virtual to the on-site, and to have it be a recognizable and accreting, advancing experience.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not in contention with one another, but rather mutually reinforcing. And frankly, there's some things you can do better online and some things you can do better on-site.
That's right. Well, let's talk about on-site and getting back to the dioramas. Some of the exhibits that were created decades ago don't fully or accurately reflect the history that is depicted in those scenes. And let me just cite one example. And that would be the diorama with Peter Stuyvesant, the colonial governor of New Netherland, and he was meeting with the Lenape and an indigenous tribe inhabiting New Amsterdam. An example of that would be a diorama with Peter Stuyvesant, colonial governor of New Netherland, meeting with the Lenape, an indigenous tribe inhabiting New Amsterdam. What was wrong with the way that scene was depicted, and what did the museum do to help address it?
It's such an interesting project, and it's a manifestation of an interesting issue for institutions that are as old as we are, 150 years,
yeah,
and that are as large as we are, and that's that sometimes things get out of date. This was an example of a diorama that was not only out of date, but inappropriately so, and we were trying to figure out how to address it most effectively. And after a great deal of introspection and dialogue about that, we decided that the best way to do it was explicitly and overtly so that the public could engage in how things had changed with us. In other words, not take the diorama out, not simply remove the inappropriate signage, but rather to layer literally on top of the glass new signage that shared with people the fact that some of the presentations were stereotypical. Many of them were inappropriate culturally and inaccurate. And so what we did was we put a big label right across the glass of the diorama and said, what's wrong with this picture? And then we went through issue by issue, the dress of the Native Americans, mm-hmm, the stance of the original New Yorkers, and how it was all off balance and inaccurate and in the wrong cultural representation, and we corrected it.
Yeah, that is so smart and so thoughtful, because if we're going to face our history, sometimes it has to be presented, and there are so many others who would have wanted to throw a blanket over it and pretend it never happened, and that doesn't do anybody any good.
But you know what's very interesting? So many more people are stopping to look at this diorama.
That's great.
They used to walk past it,
uh-huh,
which may have been a good thing when it was out of date that taking it in. But now that it's been treated, they can see that there's something different, and they're stopping, and they're reading, and they're really enjoying it. It's been extremely well received, and we're proud of it. But we are still learning, and we're still working on these issues of how to best take each explicit case of this and have the right intervention and the right treatment.
A very constructive approach. You have been deeply concerned about the state of science learning in the schools and the urgent need to improve it. And your institution, although you're a museum, you're doing more and more science-based learning, and you're doing it in a very creative and innovative way. Tell us about some of those efforts.
Well, it goes all the way back to those founders you asked about,
yeah,
because one of the great insights they had was, in addition to making us a traditional museum and a place of scientific research, they also specifically wrote in to our charter that we be a place for what was then fairly charmingly called popular instruction, which is code for education.
Yes.
And so we've always had a really important blend mission of science and education that's only grown, I think, more and more in the last period of years. And we feel that this is absolutely critical for the very reason that we were discussing before. As the issues of our time are more explicitly science-based, it is increasingly urgent that the general public have a capacity to engage those issues. In addition, I think it's vital for young people who are going to be coming forward at a time when most of the jobs are going to have levels of scientific dimensionality to them. It doesn't mean they're all going to be scientists. Then that we prepare them for the workforce.
Mm-hmm.
And beyond that, for our country's own competitiveness and security going forward, we have to be at the cutting edge. So we've taken a very strong position that we want to be the place that is training the next generation of scientists, the next generation of science teachers, and the next generation and the current generations of a scientifically literate populace that is prepared to exercise the franchise thoughtfully.
Yeah, and you certainly have an expertise in knowing how to present this science in an accessible and engaging way, perhaps even more than a lot of schools do.
Well, I think we're also relieved of the burden of having to present a textbook.
Yeah.
We have
standards and things of that sort.
But we keep our eye not only on the standards,
sure,
but also on what the teachers are required to teach, because if we're going to be in the business, and we are, of training teachers, whether it's through our master's program or through programs that certify teachers for teaching science, it's critical that we meet them where they need to do their work mm-hmm. and not ask them to go on a side adventure. And we're highly cognizant of that. For example, we have a program called Urban Advantage that we do with all of the other scientifically rich nonprofit institutions around New York, the Botanical Gardens, the zoos, the Hall of Science, et cetera, across all five boroughs. And it's in its 11th year. And we've been training thousands and thousands of teachers and students. And it meets them at the eighth grade exit project. They can't get promoted to the next grade without this. And it's a test in science. And so it's a real thing for them and for the teachers. They do their projects in our institutions. We work with their teachers as mm-hmm. well. And we send all these children who go through this program home with free passes for their families. And they come back in with their siblings so proud to show them their institution. But I think this point of really having it tied to what the standards are, help teachers and schools fulfill those requirements, and in a sense, having the classroom extend beyond the walls of the schoolhouse into the great resources of a city like New York. And that's where the name is derived from, mm-hmm. Urban Advantage, because for all the challenges of urban education, we have one great advantage, which is all these institutions that are here to participate. And it's really changed our role, actually, because it's not just that we're assisting. We're actually accountable with everybody mm-hmm. for making these programs work.
Very cool. You also, Ellen, have been a big champion for girls in STEM. Are we gaining traction? Are we making headway in those efforts?
Well, I've been involved in STEM education for girls and women since my days at Barnard College.
Right.
And though I should say very quickly, as you know, I am not a scientist, though I have long loved nature and science.
Where did that come from? Because you were an English major.
Right.
You're a lawyer.
I am.
And you were the president of Barnard for 13 years. Where did that love from science emanate from?
It came from my childhood.
Yeah.
And I always loved nature. I collected. I was a little collector, like so many children are. I'm one of those little collectors. I collected shells. I collected rocks. I loved butterflies uh-huh. from a very young age. Still do all those things. Still collect those shells. And so it's always something I've cared about and understood. And I think that having a relationship with nature is so important at every stage of our life. It's grounding, literally. It's deeply moving, and it makes us care about where we are, the environment, and the world around us.
Well, let us get back to the sesquicentennial, because you have an ambitious slate of projects and exhibits and events which even extend beyond this year. And let us start with the place we have to start, which is dinosaurs. Tell us about T-Rex, the ultimate predator.
Well, we did have a sense that maybe the way to kick off our sesquicentennial was obviously with T-Rex. But the reason that it was so appropriate, apart from T-Rex just being inherently cool,
yes.
Is also that there's so much new science about T-Rex. You know, it just never gets old. And our scientists are out there every year and finding new things. And so today, we know that they may have had feathers.
Mm-hmm.
Today we're trying to figure out what color were they. Today we can literally recreate, and we do in the exhibit, what the power of their crunch and bite was. I mean, this is very cool stuff. We do use new technology, virtual reality, and all the rest in this show to demonstrate each of these things. So it's a very cool show. It looks and feels different, but it's still about everybody's favorite dinosaur.
And it should be noted that the man who discovered T-Rex was an employee of the museum.
Barnum Brown.
Yeah. Very cool.
Part of our history. Well, that's why we're celebrating. We do have, as you were alluding to, a great and glorious history, a wonderful culture. But I think what's so thrilling is to see how the idea that you were alluding to earlier for this institution began mm-hmm. and how it's blossomed. Because for all of the vision and ambition that our founders had, I don't think that even they would have understood not just the role that we play in the city, which has also changed,
yeah.
not just a place to go, but a driving force in New York City itself, across five boroughs and in education and for tourism, but also that we're playing a national role and a global role in science, in discovery, in education, and we're at the core of so many of the most important issues.
Mm-hmm. Another anniversary this year is going to be the 50th anniversary of the moon landing. What's going on up at the Hayden Planetarium?
Well, as you were saying, we have a lot of excitement around our 150th anniversary. We're an institution that knows how to party. And so, among other things, we're going to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the moonwalk, but we're going to also celebrate the 50th anniversary of Earth Day.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of other things along the way. On the 50th anniversary of the moonwalk, which is this summer,
yep.
We're going to have a major event around that. And then next year, we're going to have a new space show, and everybody loves a new space show. So there's lots coming.
There sure is. And perhaps the capstone of all this will be the $383 million Richard Gilder Center for Science, Education, and Innovation. What are those plans? And what will this mean to the future of the museum?
Well, this is a very important project. First of all, it's the first time that we've ever put what we actually do, in addition to our wonderful donor, Richard Gilder's name, but for science, education, and innovation. That's actually what we're about.
Mm-hmm.
And I
yeah.
think that those words are particularly important now that people understand that. But inside of it is going to be really some thrilling things. I do want to say one word about the architecture, because our magnificent architect, Jeannie Gang,
yeah.
was just named to the Time 100 list. And I believe that the words that they used were that she's going to be, is the most important architect of our time, which is pretty great to hear. But why we chose her was, interestingly, because we're a museum and a park and we're very environmentally minded, we wanted somebody who had a great sensibility not only to the built environment, as you would expect mm-hmm. an architect to, but also to the natural environment. And Jeannie brings that to us, and she's produced a glorious building, inside of which will be a couple of really fabulous things among many others. One is an insectarium. For all of the things that we have never had a grand hall for insects. Insects are one of the most important creatures on Earth today and probably always.
Mm-hmm.
They are a critical vector for human health, both good and bad. People tend to know the bad, not so much the good.
Yep.
And also for the environment. And we're going to bring all of that out. And they're everywhere, including right here in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the ones we don't like and some of the ones that we love. In addition to the insectarium, there's going to be a magnificent theater. It's called the Invisible Worlds Theater, and it will be a place that we take you to see the research that our scientists are doing in a pioneering way that almost always is not visible to the naked eye. And so we're going to take you to the depths of the ocean floor, the outer reaches of the atmosphere, inside the human body and the brain, or into a jungle and a leaf, and it's going to be quite different and quite fantastic. And then one of the other things that really excites us about this building, and this may just be because we watch what happens there every day, for the first time, visitors are going to be able to come in and not hit dead ends and circulate around all the public floors in a way that will ease their journey and how crowded it can be.
Oh, that's so interesting. It does sound amazing. When is it going to open?
It's going to open in 2021. It, you know, it's a construction schedule.
I don't understand how that all goes, but it sounds like you do have a plan.
We have a plan. And we're excited about
yeah. it. Ellen, running complex institutions like the American Museum of Natural History is one expensive enterprise. Are there any guiding principles you adhere to both on the expense and the revenue side?
I think there are a couple of things that one thinks about. Certainly when you take on a big project, you want to be sure you can afford it. And so we certainly, for most of our capital work, we certainly try to fund things up front.
Mm-hmm.
When it's a great big project, you get a big chunk of it up front, and then you might allow yourself time to finish it up.
Yeah.
But and so we adhere to that. We're fairly quite disciplined in these ways. So that I think that's first. I think on budgets, we believe in a balanced budget. And sometimes when you have new things, you have to say to yourself, well, what might we not do? That's usually very, very difficult. It's almost never about things that you don't admire. It's almost never about things that you don't wish you were doing. But it's hard, and you have to make choices.
And are people involved.
Exactly.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about your organizational culture and what makes the museum such a very special place in which to work.
I'm so happy to have that question today, because in the context of our 150th, last night we had literally a birthday party, 150th birthday party for all of our staff, all of our volunteers,
oh,
and our trustees. And one of the things that we talked about was how long people tend to work at the museum. We have people who have been there not 1 year, 5 years, though of course we have those as well, but 10 years, 20 years, 25 years.
You don't find that in today's world.
That's right. 30 years, 40 years. We even had one fellow who's with us 50 years. And I think that that tells you something about the place. First of all, I think people have a great passion about what we do for the institution. You mentioned at the beginning that there's nowhere that people love more. When I say what I do, most people will look at me and say, it's my favorite place.
Yeah.
How nice is that? But so would our staff, which doesn't mean we're perfect. On the other hand, we are representative in every way, I think, of New York City and its great diversity. Because of all that global work that we do, and we're truly a global institution, we have a global perspective, we're interested in different perspectives, we're about anthropology and different cultures. We are also, like almost every other institution that I know today, we're working really hard to do even better on issues of diversity and equity and inclusion, and surely we can. But we bring to it a real admiration and embracing of these issues, and I think our staff know it, which doesn't mean that they don't know what we don't get right sometimes, because we're all human.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one of the greatest perks of working there, is telling somebody you work there. And your coolness factor goes up just like that.
You know, it's really true. Certainly mine has, but maybe I had a low start.
Boy, since you started back in 1993, society has changed dramatically. But I'd be curious how you have changed, and more specifically, how the way you lead this institution today is different than it was back in the early 1990s.
Well, I think we are more inclusive. I think you have to be today, and you have to seek more voices. I think that we live in very complex times, and I think in the immediate present, we live in times that are not only complex, but they're intense, and people bring a depth of feeling, whether it be born of anger, not necessarily at the institution itself, I mean in the condition that surround us all, or whether it be frustration or just passion for what they care about. And I think that therefore one leads with great sensitivity today, and with a strong desire to be inclusive. Although you can't include everybody in every decision, obviously, and you can't please everybody all the time. On the other hand, you can listen and you can be responsive as appropriate. So I think we're trying, all of us who are running institutions today are trying to do that better and better every day.
Yeah, it just seems that people sometimes will go along with the decision as long as their voice has been heard. And they'll go along with whatever you decide or whatever the institution decides. It's when their voice is not heard that they really get frustrated.
Well, the way that tends to be expressed in nonprofits like ours, and I think more and more in for-profits, is process. That if people feel and in fact are part of a process, and they both come away with a better understanding and they do feel heard.
Let me close with this, Ellen. Share with us a moment or two, perhaps a story that someone has told you and what the museum has meant to them, or maybe just capturing some kid taking this all in one day that maybe in the scheme of things isn't that big, but it was that big to them and really warmed your heart.
Well, I think one of the things that happened very early on when I was in the museum, and I just have always loved it, is you're wandering through, for me, in my case, going from one meeting to another.
Yes.
And as I'm wandering through, I look up and I see and hear a youngster standing in front of a diorama, and I see the parent or the caregiver saying, come on, come on, come on, as we all have done in our lives. And I think he looks at her and he just says, wait. I just gotta see this. Uh-huh. And that's the moment. I mean, it's the moment when you know that they're taking it in, because what our institution can do almost like no other is create a sense of wonder and reinforce a sense of curiosity. These are the gateways to learning. Mm-hmm. This is where it begins, an interest in science, an interest in the world around us, a desire to protect this environment, and boy, do we need it.
Yeah, that's for sure. Well, Ellen Futter, the president of the American Museum of Natural History, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Now, you have a website which is solely dedicated to the 150th. Tell us about that and how people can get actively engaged in this anniversary.
Well, this goes directly, by the way, to your earlier question about how do we lead differently. One thing we do very differently is invite the public to engage with us and to participate way more than we ever used to. And I think that's true for everybody. So as part of our 150th, everybody should feel that they're part of it. And on our website, you can share with us a story, your reactions, anything you feel like. We're looking forward to receiving it and to hearing from all those people who love us.
Great idea. Well, there are going to be a lot of them. Thanks, Ellen. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thanks so much.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
The Business of Giving can be heard every Sunday evening between 6 and 7 p.m. Eastern on AM 970 The Answer in New York and on iHeartRadio. You can follow us at Biz of Give on Twitter and at Facebook.com/Business of Giving.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.